President Trump stumps in Pennsylvania, the Keystone State, key to the House majority in the midterms. Trump's poll numbers there, stone cold sour. Months from now, cutting edge AI models will outsmart the world's best cybersecurity firewalls. Whoa, that sounds scary, is it? We're going to try to find out. The president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors is also the mayor of San Diego, and guess what? We graduated from the same high school, Todd Gloria, in studio. Hello, everyone. I'm Major Garrett in Washington. Welcome to The Takeout. Pennsylvania is known as the Keystone State. Why? Because it was central to the commerce, population, and politics of the 13 American colonies. And as you well know, Pennsylvania has played an outsized role in presidential politics for decades and will loom large in the midterms with at least three hotly contested House races and possibly as many as four. Quick reminder, Republicans currently hold 218 House seats. That's the slimmest majority possible. President Trump traveled to a Mack truck facility a bit west of Allentown this afternoon, knowing Republicans need to perform well in Pennsylvania. As you might recall, last night on this program, we reviewed new national CBS poll numbers on Trump, the Iran war, and his overall approval rating. Quick recap, 62% disapprove of Trump's performance, 38% approve. Also, 69% told us the Iran war was not worth the cost. 31% said it was. Again, those are national numbers. What about numbers in Pennsylvania? A new Franklin and Marshall College poll found 47% of Pennsylvanians consider that state to be on the wrong track. That same number, 47%, say they are worse off financially than they were a year ago. 35% of Pennsylvanians say the economy was their number one issue. And of those who said that, 42% favored Democrats over Republicans at 24%. Continuing on with that Franklin and Marshall College poll, 29% said the Pennsylvania economy was either excellent or good. 71% said it was fair or poor. That compares to 39% who said the state economy was excellent or good in March. Remember, that was just after the Iran war began. Lastly, that poll found Pennsylvanians favored Democrats in the midterms on a generic ballot question, which is pretty important, 47% to 35% over Republicans. All this in a state Trump carried by more than 120,000 votes in 2024. By far his best performance in three presidential runs. He lost Pennsylvania in 2020 and won it by a mere 44,000 votes in 2016. So, Trump has a sales job to do in Pennsylvania and elsewhere for what it might be worth. And as he does that salesmanship job, it is becoming obvious day by day the disagreements with Iran over the meaning of the Memorandum of Understanding. Well, those disagreements appear to be multiplying. And that adds a layer of confusion to what's been agreed to and what's still left to resolve. This includes nuclear inspections, Lebanon, sanctions, ballistic missiles, and the Strait of Hormuz. To help us with the politics, the salesmanship, and the Iran talks, we turn to Weijia Jiang at the White House. Weijia, let's start with inspectors inside Iran, which the vice president made a lot about yesterday. The president talked about that today.
That's right, Major. You remember Vice President Vance said it was the most exciting piece of the negotiations that he had in Switzerland with Iranian officials, because he said that Iran has agreed to allow those nuclear inspectors, those watchdogs, back into the country. Well, today we heard from Iran to say that they have not met with the agency in charge of it all and that there are no plans for inspections, prompting President Trump to publicly contradict the Iranians. And here's what he said.
They're wrong. They're wrong. They're wrong. They know they're wrong. They told us inside and we have it down 100% inspections. And if they were right, I'd cancel the meetings right now.
When will those inspectors actually be on the ground?
At the appropriate time. At the appropriate time. There's no rush, but they'll be on the ground at the appropriate time.
There is also a disagreement, Major, over how Iran can use its revenue that is new after the Treasury Department issued waivers for sanctions on Iranian oil, meaning that anyone who purchases it now does not have to face U.S. consequences for roughly 2 months. The president insists that any profits Iran makes will actually come back to the U.S., to American farmers, saying that Iran is going to purchase corn and soybeans because there is a humanitarian crisis in the country, which, of course, is true. But the Iranians say, look, that's not up to President Trump. We are going to spend the money how we want it, with the head of Iran's central bank saying they are under no obligation to purchase American agriculture products. So, Major, we are already seeing a lot of disagreement in public, which we typically don't when you're talking about such vulnerable negotiations. But we'll see how this plays out, because there's still roughly 2 months left to go on these talks.
And the talks and their future workability also vector off of Lebanon and Israel's presence in southern Lebanon, and whether or not the ceasefire between Hezbollah and Iranian proxy in southern Lebanon holds with Israel.
Absolutely. And there is disagreement there that has been ongoing, even though we know that the Israelis and Lebanese delegations continue to work this out with meetings in Washington. The Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, just said a couple days ago that they are not going to be moving out of southern Lebanon, stressing that they need to maintain a security posture there. And when our Ed O'Keefe pressed President Trump about this, because Iran has made so clear that any ceasefire has to include Lebanon, the president said, I'm not going to tell you my plan, but he tried to reassure the American public that he has one, and that when it comes to Bibi, he also is able to make progress. But so far, Major, nothing that we have seen has amounted to concrete progress in terms of those troops from Israel withdrawing.
Weijia Jiang with all the details from the North Lawn of the White House. Weijia, as always, thank you so much. CBS News National Security Contributor Samantha Vinograd joins me now. Sam, always great to have you here. Get to the crux of this, if you could, please.
It's like a tale of two talks. We have Vice President Vance and other officials saying that everything is proceeding swimmingly and that Iran has agreed to basically all of the U.S. demands, including these critical inspections by the IAEA. And then we have Iran, Oman, and even Pakistan saying something very different. We now have discordancy not just on nuclear inspections, also on tolls or fees that could be charged in the Strait of Hormuz.
That's what the Iranians and the Oman government are going to be talking about in the not-too-distant future.
Certainly, and they issued a statement a few hours ago saying that they could look at any cost for services provided in the Strait. We have disagreement on whether ballistic missiles are going to be covered.
And right. The Prime Minister of Pakistan said today, well, I'm not going to care about that. Why should I worry about someone's self-defense capabilities or ballistic missile
capabilities? And other countries have them.
Other countries have them. Why can't Iran?
Which is half true. But in any case, there is also disagreement. Marco Rubio is in the region. He'll be going to a GCC meeting on whether Iranian-backed proxies in the region are going to be part of negotiations. So all across the board, it looks like this MOU was hammered out without a lot of tough conversations happening, and perhaps with a lot left open to interpretation. The problem is, Major, that President Trump is saying, if the Iranians don't play ball, I'm walking away and I'm going to reengage in military operations. However, at the same time, Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth has just provided Congress with an $80 billion bill, basically, for this war. And President Trump has said just last week that this war was having such an impact on the economy that that's why that he ended it. So I don't think
didn't
the Iranians
want to become Herbert
seriously.
Hoover.
Exactly.
His words, not mine. And that $80 billion request from Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is a supplemental to basically provide things that have been launched in this war to rebuild stockpiles that have clearly been fired down.
And it's also a little bit misleading, because that $80 billion, even if Congress says, here you go,
which is not clear it's going to do.
And the Senate just voted to restrict Trump's
war powers,
which is a rare rebuke by the Senate.
50 to 48.
But even if Congress hands Trump a check for $80 billion, that masks the reality that it is going to take years to rebuild weapon stockpiles, even if all the money comes in now. So the true costs of this war are really hard to put into figures in a bank account. And so at this point, President Trump is feeling a lot of economic pressure today because of the war. He has said publicly that it's too expensive and having too much of a downside risk to the economy to go back. And the Iranians seem to have gotten a lot out of this financially. I know there's a lot of focus on the $300 billion reconstruction account, but as our colleague Ouija just mentioned, just waiving sanctions on Iranian
which happened
oil
yesterday.
Exports. Yes, a general license by the U.S. Treasury Department is going to lead to billions of U.S. dollars going to Iran. And there's a lot of he said, she said right now, but the proof is in the pudding. Is Iran getting paid in U.S. dollars or not? And what account is that going to?
Right. And to be clear, that's not U.S. taxpayer dollars. That's transacted oil sales in the essential currency of the globe, which is U.S. dollars.
It is not U.S. government money, but to be clear, Iran today, as President Trump is saying, the oil is flowing. That is money that the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, a designated foreign terrorist organization, is getting, billions of dollars that it's getting, that it was not getting before this war. Why? Because it is a state-sponsored terror. It has an illegal nuclear program. It uses ballistic missiles illegally. It engages in human rights abuses, and I could go on. So Iran is richer today than before the war, despite the fact that they've done nothing better since the war started.
Sam Vinograd, great
Thank
stuff
you.
As always. Thank you. Voters are heading to the polls in four states today. Primaries are taking place in Utah, Maryland, and New York, while South Carolina holds its runoff elections. We've got team coverage. Chanel Call has the latest out of New York. Skylar Henry following South Carolina races from Atlanta. Let's begin with Chanel. Chanel, what do you got?
Well, we're coming to you, Major, from a polling station here in Harlem in New York City. And Mayor Zoran Mamdani, he is not on the ballot, but could be a huge reason why people are coming out to vote today in these primary races. This is someone, as you know, Major, who ran as a Democratic Socialist last year. He had this huge victory here in New York City in 2025. And now he's chosen to endorse candidates in three districts, 7, 10, and 13. Now, the interesting thing here is whether or not his endorsement will actually matter when it comes to getting people out to vote. And what could that say? Well, Major, many people say that if he's actually successful in supporting these candidates to a victory here in New York City in these three races, it could prove that New York City is moving more towards the progressive left. It could also signal that Mayor Zoran Mamdani's power and influence could stretch beyond New York City.
And you're also following a primary in a district where Mayor Mamdani has not endorsed, the 12th Congressional District. What are you hearing
there? Yeah, this is an interesting race, Major. And that's because this seat is open for the first time in almost three decades because Jerry Nadler is retiring. It's a pretty crowded race already, and it's going to be a tight one. The front runners here include someone named Micah Lasher. This is someone who's already been endorsed by both Nadler and New York Governor Kathy Hochul. He's going to be up against Alex Boris. Really interesting guy, not a career politician, someone who worked in data analytics and really made AI reform the centerpiece of his campaign. There are people who agree that that should happen, and then, of course, those who disagree. A lot of people throwing money behind both of those perspectives. You have these political groups that are backed by some of the biggest AI tech companies in America right now that have fueled these million-dollar ad campaigns, sometimes was seen during the Knicks game as well. And this has now become, this race in particular, one of the most expensive House primary races in American history. We talked to some voters. Here's some sound from one of them in District 12.
This particular neighborhood in this district has a very high voter turnout, a lot of interest in politics. I think we have two really good candidates in Lasher and Boris. Obviously, I think Lasher is better. He has more experience and more policy knowledge.
And Major, you also have some big star power that's part of this race. Jack Schlossberg, who is the grandson of JFK, also throwing his hat in the ring here in District 12. This is someone who has a huge social media online presence. So we'll just have to wait and see how this plays out.
Chanel Call coming to us from Harlem. Thank you very, very much. I want to turn now to Skylar Henry. Skylar, walk us through South Carolina and a last minute redo of an endorsement that President Trump had already made to try to cover his bets.
You took the words right out of my mouth, Major. That is essentially what this appears to be, especially considering the fact that a few weeks before that June 9th, primary, all eyes were on the lieutenant governor, Pamela Evett, suggesting that she had the momentum because she had the lone endorsement of President Trump. Now the president over the weekend throwing his support behind both Evett as well as the state's attorney general, Alan Wilson. He said in a Truth Social post that both have had amazing careers and have been with him from the beginning, calling them MAGA and America First all the way. He said that he can't hurt one of them by only endorsing the other, so therefore he's going to endorse them both. Interesting. Now, let's look at what that essentially means. For Evett, that essentially could be somewhat of a weakening position, so to speak. She is someone who has touted herself as not only a MAGA warrior, but someone who has aligned themselves with President Trump and someone who, based off of political campaigns and advertisements, had used the president's endorsement as sort of fuel for her political momentum. Wilson, on the other hand, over the course of the last several weeks, has been building this coalition of support, many of whom from some of the most prominent Republicans in the Palmetto State altogether, including some of the gubernatorial hopefuls that he beat out against just a few weeks ago. That includes Congresswoman Nancy Mace, Congressman Ralph Norman. We should point out Senator Tim Scott also came out relatively recently to throw his support behind Alan Wilson as well. So there's this coalition, this groundswell, if you will, that has been building up over the course of the last several days and weeks, to be topped off, of course, by President Trump. We'll see if Wilson has the momentum needed in order to earn that nomination, then, of course, go up against Jermaine Johnson, the Democratic nominee, in November.
Skyler, I do apologize for stealing your thunder. Our anchors should never do that. They should be much more careful than I was, and I apologize for that, my brother. There is a sense here in Washington that Trump and those close to him politically, on the political evaluation side, we're looking at internal showing a bit of a surge for Alan Wilson, and they did not want to miss out on that. And that is what explains subtly behind the scenes this now dual endorsement, which is not taking anything away from Evett, Pamela Evett, but does give something valuable in the last minute to Wilson.
That's right. Momentum through and through, and certainly something that you can absolutely take away from, especially considering the fact that almost instantly, the night that she conceded, Congresswoman Nancy Mace sort of led the charge, so to speak, in terms of other notable Republicans from South Carolina to say, hey, we think that Wilson is going to be the conservative voice that we need in order to move forward in this race. You take that along with the other gubernatorial hopefuls that were out there, Senator Tim Scott out there as well. I think it should be interesting. I think some internal polling showed that there is still relatively a tight race. I think Wilson somewhere around 49%, Evett somewhere around 47%. There was a significant number of voters who came out during the early voting period, just north of 70,000, which is considerable, especially considering the short window that is there between the June 9th primary and the runoff that we have here today. Should be interesting to see what happens when polls close here tonight.
Skyler Henry dialed in on all the politics as usual. I thank you, sir. Still to come, government and private sector cybersecurity protections could be vulnerable to advanced AI models. When, you might ask? In months. That's the new warning from U.S. intelligence and top U.S. allies. Also, mayor of San Diego, and you know I have kind of a thing for my hometown, Todd Gloria hits the big time. What's the big time? Here. Here's the big time. Congress is about to pass a big new housing bill, and we will get Gloria's take. Plus, we will take you live to a Boston sports bar where R. Kelly O'Grady and English football fans revel and probably drink a thing or two in World Cup mania. The takeout returns in 90 seconds. Welcome back to The Takeout. An international alliance is warning that advanced artificial intelligence models are presently on the brink of being able to overwhelm cybersecurity systems for both governments and businesses. And that guidance came from something known as the Five Eyes Spy Agency Alliance, which consists of the security agencies in the United States, Britain, Australia, Canada, and New Zealand. That consortium says all of this damaging stuff could happen in mere months. The former director of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, Chris Krebs, joins me now. I'm also happy to say that Chris is a CBS News contributor. Chris, this sounds scary. You and I have talked cybersecurity for years. This sounds scarier than our earlier conversations, is it?
It's pretty alarming. The past several months have been a bit of a whirlwind in terms of advanced AI, dating back almost, you know what, 2.5 months ago to the first announcement of Anthropic's Mythos model and capability. And this note from the Five Eyes intelligence agencies, while not really a single development, it's a signal that businesses need to take the risk posed by AI falling into the wrong hands very seriously.
It also says in its statement that if you don't do what you just said, you will not be able in the very near future to prevent escalation into major operational and financial crises. What does that mean?
Look, I mean, it means you're not going to be able to operate in a world where you have vulnerabilities all over your systems that you haven't patched. That means everyone from an intelligence service in the Chinese government all the way down to just a random fraudster or scammer that's operating somewhere on the other side of the world might be able to get into your systems and shut you down. And look, this is not the end of the world, though, which I think is the good news. And there, that alert from the Five Eyes lays out a couple of discrete and achievable actions that any business can take on board in the next couple months and kind of get right, make themselves harder targets, make themselves more agile, more resilient, and prepare for what you know people are calling the vulnerability tsunami that's heading our way.
Okay, let's use another metaphor. It's a backyard brawl, and the hackers have AI, so the good guys need AI of their own. So why can't we just sic AI on AI?
Hey, if anybody's read the William Gibson book Neuromancer from 1984, that's really what it projected. That's the book where we first got the word cyberspace, but it was about good AI and bad AI going at it across the internet. And that's really what not just the future looks like, but it's about to happen today. And there are AI companies, cybersecurity companies that are launching every single day with tons of backing from venture capital and sovereign funds just for that eventuality that the bad guys are coming. We need to get ready. And the good news is it's really a speed thing. So the more tools you have that are out there looking, that are out there responding to the bad guys, you might make it through this okay.
I want to try to pinpoint the potential big picture risk, Chris, and see if you agree with this. You might recall not too long ago on Face the Nation, my colleague Margaret Brennan had the IMF, International Monetary Fund Managing Director on, and she said, quote, "The world does not have the ability currently to protect the international monetary system against massive cyber risks." Let me repeat that. International monetary system against massive cyber risks. Do you believe it's that large a potential problem?
Look, when you've got Jamie Dimon, the head of JP Morgan, directly calling Secretary Bessent at the Treasury, raising the alarm over Mythos and the AI risk, yeah, there's something going on here. Those guys are pretty serious. They're also not necessarily known to hyperbole. So I think there are some risks. I think there are some concerns. I think that's why this administration over the last couple weeks has really ratcheted up their approach to addressing AI risk. It used to be kind of a laissez-faire, do what you need to do. Let's you know, stoke the innovation engine. Now it's a much more cautious. They're using export controls against Anthropic to pull the model back, the Mythos and Fable models. And so there is concern, and they're using the tools available, which unfortunately is probably the biggest issue right now, is that Congress has not put out legislation to set a predictable, standards-based approach to evaluating risk around AI. And we need to get on that sooner rather than later.
What Chris Krebs just described is by far the biggest regulatory U-turn of the second Trump term on AI. Chris Krebs, always a pleasure, sir.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Next, the mayor of San Diego. You know San Diego's my hometown. Todd Gloria, he stops by the takeout to talk about the city, affordability, and a lot more when we come back. Mm-hmm. Welcome back to The Takeout. Welcome to the Conversation Corner. Love to be here. Yesterday, the Senate, this is important. It didn't get a lot of attention. Overwhelmingly approved one of the largest pieces of federal housing legislation in two decades. Now, the House later this week is expected to pass the bill. That means it's going to President Trump's desk. It aims to lower housing costs by restricting investors, big investors, from buying single-family homes and also encouraging zoning reforms to make it easier to increase the housing stock, apartments, single-family, et cetera. Joining me now, big champion of this bill, though he's not directly involved in it because he's the mayor of San Diego, but he's also the president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, Todd Gloria. Mr. Mayor, it's good to have you. Welcome to The Takeout.
Major, it's great to be here.
We went to James Madison High School together, and you graduated as student body president. I just graduated, okay? Leave it at that.
And we're both here now.
And we're both here now. What's so good about this housing bill? What does it do that you think makes a difference in communities like our hometown of San Diego and elsewhere?
Well, you don't have enough time because it is, as you said, a comprehensive piece of legislation and the first piece of housing legislation of this kind in decades, right? So this is a big deal. What I would say is on a small level, one of the provisions that I'm super excited about is cities like San Diego, where we are unabashedly pro-housing and we doubled the number of new home permits in our city over the last 5 years. Cities like ours are going to get rewarded with more federal resources to pay for the infrastructure that goes with that housing.
That you have to have.
That you have to have.
Or you will ruin things that you're trying to improve.
It's a risk. It's a risk. And what this will allow me to do.
If you don't have sewer and parking and other things, things get rickety.
You have to have both. And in our town, you know, we charge developers for the opportunity to build in communities, but additional resources will certainly be helpful. And what that will do, not every mayor, not every city is like us, right? So that'll get more folks in the game. San Diego cannot solve this nation's housing crisis by ourselves. Bills like this will get more folks off the sidelines and get them in the game so they can build housing in their communities and our nation's housing crisis can get less acute.
California historically has had a harsh attitude in a regulatory and zoning way about real estate and development. Does this break through some of that?
It does. It does
incentivize. And I know there's a new conversation going on in California, but this federal legislation probably will egg that on.
Well, I think it'll complement it. I mean, certainly cities like mine are leading. California increasingly is encouraging more cities to do what we're doing in San Diego. But this national bill complements that, both by incentivizing localities like mine to cut red tape and streamline approvals, but also by saying for federal legislation or federal programs to also streamline some of the environmental reviews that are there that often add more time. Time is money. This is why housing gets more expensive. If the city, state, and federal government are all rowing in the same direction, what you'll start seeing is rents start to level off, go down, and maybe more people in this country will be able to buy their own home, which should not be so extraordinary, but increasingly is. That's why this legislation is important.
We talked about this on my program last week, Mr. Mayor. 42 cities, if I remember the number correctly, now where the entry-level home costs $1 million. Yeah. San Diego was there a long time ago.
Correct.
This is a problem, not just in San Diego, but nationwide.
I love that you know that. And as president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, there's a reason why this is our number one issue. Because it doesn't matter Republican or Democrat, coastal or inland, all of us are dealing with it. It may be $1,000 a month rent in a city like Kansas City, but it's $3,000 a month in a city like mine. Both of them are unaffordable in those respective communities. We have to have national action. This is what this will help us do. It is unquestionably, I think, the biggest issue in our country. It is climate issue. It is an economy issue. It's a workforce issue. It is the defining issue. And ask any young person out there right now, particularly college students, kids who've done everything right, did everything they were told to do.
They think it's hopeless.
Correct. And what kind of country are we going to be if you don't feel like there's a hope and there's future for you? This bill is the first sign in decades the federal government gets it and is willing to do something about it. And it holds people like me more accountable in our own respective local communities to do more, too. That's great.
Why does the U.S. Conference of Mayors matter? And a quick bit of history, because I noted it in your, I think it was your keynote address when you became president. I didn't know this. U.S. Conference of Mayors forged in the Great Depression, correct. 1932. And your argument then was mayors rallied to go to Washington and say, hey, there are massive problems. And that's what you think the Conference of Mayors needs to do in this particular moment.
In our nearly 100-year history, that is constantly what we've done. In our best moments, that's what we've done. Whether it's the depths of the Depression, during the Civil Rights Movement, during the AIDS crisis, it was mayors from across the country that often, in response to lack of federal action, came to Washington, D.C. and got the job done. Back in 1932, it was a man named Frank Murphy. He was the mayor of Detroit, Michigan, called a bunch of mayors together, depths of the Depression, soup lines, bread lines, and said, we've got to have something happen. Fundamentally changed the way the federal government interacts with local cities. To this day, That's the kind of impact that mayors can have when they set aside partisanship, come to Washington and explain ourselves. In this case, that's happening this week, too. We have been pounding the pavement for 3 years now saying we have to have federal housing legislation, and we are probably 48 hours away from that happening. It's very exciting.
In your speech, you said mayors are accountable and they must build trust with the public. A little bit of San Diego business here. Unsuccessful in a couple of ballot initiatives to get new revenue to the city. That means there's a trust issue. But you have not sold San Diegans on the need for more revenue, which means there have been cuts. You just approved a budget with almost $120 million in cuts that you didn't like, city council didn't like, nobody likes. You're wrestling with things where there's a trust and accountability set of questions going on.
It's been a vicious circle, right? Because unlike the federal government, we can't run a deficit. We have to balance. And so that necessarily means that you're making tough choices and often telling people that you love and have deep relationships with, no.
Got to pay for parking at Balboa Park. Nobody wanted to do that. Nope. Had to rescind it.
Well, we
and at
did,
the beach, too.
And we're not at the beach. We didn't charge at the beach. But in Balboa Park, yes, you're exactly right. There's also paid trash collection. Your viewers may not know. City of San Diego residents for over a century have not paid for residential trash collection. And as a consequence, we have a $120 million budget deficit. The voters, now twice, have affirmed the ability to do that. But of course, that makes some people angry. And I absolutely understand it. Change is hard. And that's what's difficult about being a mayor, is that you are most directly accountable. You disagree with the president of the United States, it is extremely unlikely you're going to see him in the frozen food aisle at your grocery store, but it is very likely you might see your mayor there. And trust me, people let me know everything from potholes to Middle East conflict.
They also let you know about the size of the city personnel and how many raises that city personnel have gotten on your watch.
That is
true. And
they're
ticked off about that.
Well, they are, but they need to know some context. You may remember that in my city, my two predecessors did not provide pay raises for a decade. And Major, I'm here to tell you that city employees don't get their gas from some place that is still charging the rates from 2016, right? Their rents have gone up, their groceries have gone up, their gas prices have gone up, but the pay for them were held flat. It's the reason why when I became mayor, almost 25% of our workforce was vacant. People weren't choosing to work for us. We had to do some catching up. That is extraordinarily expensive. There's no question about it. But when you have a police officer, a firefighter, or a lifeguard that's going to respond to your 911 call and provide you the services you need on your worst day, no one's mad about that.
Todd Gloria, President of the U.S. Conference of Mayor, Mayor of San Diego. Mr. Mayor, good to have you.
Such a pleasure.
Next, New York City coffee shop, listen to this, refunds a Democratic congressman's order and says he's not welcome to come back. Why? Dispute over Israel and Gaza. Like, really? Is that where our politics is? Our panel will talk about that in a lot more when we come back. This is The Takeout. Welcome back. Isn't it exciting? I think it is. Political panel time. Let me introduce you. Democratic strategist Haimer Moore, Republican strategist Tiffany Smiley. All right. I mentioned this before we went to break. I got to read this, folks. Yeah. There is a coffee shop in New York I've never been to. It's called Poetica. And Dan Goldman, a member of Congress, and his 7-year-old daughter, as the story goes, went in, had to use the restroom. But Dan Goldman did what I always do. If I use a restroom, I buy something. That's an iron rule, folks. If you don't follow it, start following it. Use the bathroom, buy something. Anyway, they do. Then there's a post. You can see it right now. Let me summarize it. Do you see how it doesn't taste like genocide juice? This is referring to what he bought there. Or are you still having a hard time telling the difference? Question mark. See, here at Poetica, we don't serve racists, fascists, homophobes, genocide enablers, or anyone in between. I will give you Goldman's response. I'm sorry to see this post. The barista could not have been nicer to my 7-year-old daughter and me, allowing her to use the bathroom even though we had not purchased anything. I made sure to buy a coffee in return for her kindness. I hope you at least make sure she gets the tip that she deserved. Haimer, is this where we are in our American political experience?
I hope not, Major. This is like, one is disgusting, and we talked about this a little bit. I do think the congressman, I appreciate the way he responded to this. He could have escalated this situation.
Oh, yeah.
He didn't.
I mean, if there was ever a reason or a time you could say, like, I'm going to push button escalate.
Right. Yes. And he didn't do that. But like that, this can't be the litmus test by which we are measuring our elected officials, one. And then two, he came in with such respect and he did not come in with this with disrespect. And so I'm disappointed in that. But this is an instance of showing what things are like right now on the ground. You know that.
And is this symptomatic of a conversation going on in Democratic circles?
Yeah.
About this question of Israel, Gaza, genocide, is or isn't it? And even though Dan Goldman is a critic of the Netanyahu government doesn't hesitate about that,
sure.
Still gets labeled a genocidal pro-Israel Democrat.
Yeah, and one, because he's Jewish, so we have to be very careful
right.
with
and,
that.
Right, what does that got to do? Hold on, you know, that whole idea that, he's a Jew, so therefore
exactly.
we can label him that
but
way.
But to this point, I think that's what we're starting to see. You can't, just because you're a Jewish person of Jewish descent, or you are someone who has supported Israel in the past, or support Israel currently, doesn't mean you support genocide. And I think that's what the congressman is trying to say. But to your point earlier,
that is a harder conversation.
It is a conversation for the Democratic Party. Yes, and it is. And as democratic socialism starts to rise a little bit more and this conversation becomes even more pertinent, it is happening a lot more than is being reported.
Right. Tiffany, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it's sad that Mamdani didn't make a comment.
The mayor
of New York City hasn't come out and made a comment on this. He actually declined a comment. And here we are, you know.
Because that would have been a moment.
He's the mayor of the largest, perhaps, Jewish community in the world besides Israel. And he has nothing to say. It's a sad state of political affairs. And it's a place where now we can hide behind a screen. We saw the video. The barista is obviously videoing the congressman or taking some sort of photo of him as he's being an amazing citizen. Yeah. And so you can hide behind his screen to create a scene, whatever scene you want that to be, to get attention. But I would like to see more Democrats come out against this. And speak against it and stand up for the Jewish people in this country.
Mm-hmm. Let me talk to you about the primaries today. New York, South Carolina, kind of our focus. South Carolina, a late, last-minute sort of Trump split the difference, because I think the other guy that I didn't endorse might win in South Carolina.
Well, it's not uncommon for Trump to dual endorse.
Play both sides against the middle. Make sure he's a winner either way.
He's going to do it the Trump way. So I'm not really concerned about that. I think the best person will win to represent South Carolina, and it'll, you know, move forward. I think there's other critical races that are happening in the primaries, and I think today is going to be the litmus test for Mamdani. Is he perhaps the leader, the new leader of the Democrat Party?
Well, Chaim, there are three races he's endorsed, House races in New York. Are you watching that?
Yeah, I'm watching very closely. And look, I think he is the mayor of New York, and we have many leaders of the party right now, and he's not going to become the leader.
Yeah,
of the
but
Democratic
Republicans
party.
Are always going to say that.
I think what I'm looking at, Tiffany, I'm looking at how well Hakeem Jeffries, the leader, how well Chuck Schumer are going to do in these races. I think what the biggest litmus test for Democrats right
meaning
now
who
is
they back.
Who they back. And they've been on opposite of Mamdani, the mayor.
Yeah. Right.
And so this is going to be an indicator not of who the leader of the party is. This is going to be an indicator of where Democratic Socialism is on the spectrum of Democrats and how much and how many inroads they've made over the past year, which I think has been a lot.
This is like a really overcrowded, hot and sweaty subway car ride in New York. Yeah. You got Kathy Hochul, the governor. Yeah. You got Mayor Mamdani. Yep. You got Chuck Schumer. And you've got Hakeem Jeffries, all New Yorkers, all elbowing each other. It's sweaty and hot and nobody's really happy. And we'll see when the votes are counted.
Exactly what's happening.
Who walks out fresher as a daisy than the others.
I have to say, Hakeem Jeffries.
I gotta go.
So much more to say.
Coming up, the second half of England versus God in the World Cup happening right now. Our Kelly O'Grady, you can see her. She's in a bar in Boston with a bunch of English soccer fans who I hope don't become hooligans. You're watching The Takeout. Welcome back to The Takeout. Our nation's 250th anniversary is counting today, 12 days away. The 250th, as you know, comes with a cumbersome name, semi-quincentennial. I was 14 years old when we celebrated our bicentennial. That's such an easier word to say. And I fondly remember something this TV network did for more than 2 years. Honor America with a recorded tribute to revolutionary history called The Bicentennial Minute. The Bicentennial Minute would air in the 8 o'clock hour every night only on CBS. They started July 4th, 1974, and ended December 31st, 1976. 912 bicentennial minutes in all. Actors, singers, sports figures, journalists, historians, and, of course, politicians starred in these snippets of history tied to that particular date. They were the brainchild of a woman named Ethel Winant, vice president of CBS. Winant was the first female executive at any major TV network. The Bicentennial Minutes became a kind of low-grade cultural phenomenon, beloved and, yes, gently mocked. We have happily found pristine copies of these minutes in the CBS archives and will, starting tonight, share a few of them with you as we head toward July 4th. Tonight, we start with a red-hot actor of that era, British-born Michael York.
I'm Michael York. 200 years ago today, John Rutledge joined other delegates gathering for a special session of South Carolina's newly formed assembly at Charleston's old state house. Just a month earlier, he'd been shouting that anyone who had thought of independence was guilty of treason. When Britain declared Americans rebels, Rutledge had to choose. He decided to join with the radicals to help establish a government for South Carolina independent of British authority. Rutledge was the man chosen to lead that government. He knew it would be treason against the crown, but Rutledge also felt he was caught in the sweep of a great event. He accepted the honor, telling other South Carolinians, "The eyes of the world are on America." I'm Michael York, and that's the way it was.
These historic minutes are sponsored each night by Shell.
Can't leave out the Shell sponsorship. Who better to lead us to a bar in Boston filled with English soccer fans than Michael York in that positively charming British accent? The England-Ghana game has about 90 seconds to go, plus stoppage time. The score, 0-0. Our brave and intrepid Kelly O'Grady is with the British fans who are very, very nervous. Kelly, help them through their angst.
Oh my God, Major, we're on a roller coaster of emotions here right now. I got the game over here, and I mean, this was supposed to be an easy win for England, right? They came in absolutely the favorite. Ghana, of course, also had won their match in the group, but they were the underdog. But so far, it has been physical. It has been organized. Ghana has been playing incredibly well defensively. The cheers and moans from the folks behind me, it just tells you how passionate these fans are. I actually spoke to the owner of the greatest bar where I'm at in Boston, and he said, you know, they've hosted Super Bowls, they've hosted World Series, they've hosted NBA Finals, and soccer fans are different. The World Cup is unlike anything that we've seen. Major, normally I can bring you breaking news whenever we do sports hits together. It's not looking good right now for England.
So if there's a goal scored by either side, I will know by what happens over your shoulder, Kelly O'Grady. But if there isn't a goal, talk to me about, first, the Scots were in Boston. They made a huge hit, a huge impression there. Now it's the English's turn.
That's right. The Scots, the line was that they drank Boston out of beer. We did actually ask Billy Fairweather, he's the owner of this bar here, did this happen? And he said they made a dent, but he had his suppliers here the next day. We talked to a bunch of English fans before this match. We were at their pre-party yesterday, and I said, okay, are you going to show up the Scots? And they said, yeah, if England wins, we are going to. It's not just going to be beer. It's going to be spirits. It's going to be anything you can drink but water. And I said, well, what if you lose? And they said, it's probably going to be a lot worse. I don't know. Could be a draw. Like right now, it's not looking good.
Kelly O'Grady with English soccer fans in Boston waiting for deliverance from Harry Kane. May it come to the English soccer fans. Kelly O'Grady, enjoy your time. What a grand assignment. I never get those. Happy Tuesday, everyone. This is The Takeout. You know who we are. Relentlessly curious, reliably civil, and occasionally clever.